Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Not Another Mummy Podcast with me, Alison Perry. My guest today is award-winning author and illustrator Laura Dockrill. Laura first came onto my radar when she wrote What Have I Done in 2020, sharing her experiences of postpartum psychosis. And with it being Maternal Mental Health Awareness Week, it's a really good time to talk about this. But Laura's also the author of YA books, kids books, and her first adult fiction book, I Love You, I Love You, I Love You, comes out in June. Laura, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Alison. Thanks so much for having me.
You look like a vision in pink today. You got the pink lippy, the pink shirt, the pink wall behind you. You are bringing the vibes to this morning. So good, because we're recording this on a Monday morning and it's pretty grey where I am in Southeast London. So I feel like you're bringing a bit of the colour vibe.
I'm in Southwest, so I'm sharing the same cloud as you.
But how are you doing today? Like, is today treating you well? Has it been kind to you?
I'm good. I've been at my desk since 5. You know what it's like, goodness. Still catching up with the Easter holidays juggle. But you know, I'm my best in the mornings. That's where all my ideas come, sort of fresh from my dreams or nightmares. And I'm there, ready. So I'm on I think I'm on breakfast number 4, something like that. So
you're
like my evening movie time now.
I love that. So I want to talk to you today about mental health. It's a fairly meaty topic, isn't it? But it's such an important one for us to delve into.
Oh, it's meaty.
It's so meaty. But first up, tell us what happened to you when your son was born, because he's now 5, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just turned 6, actually. I mean, every year that comes, God, how dare you not remember exactly when his birthday is, Alison. With every, year that goes by, it's like another year, you know, milestone removed from that horrific experience that we went through. So, in short, the short version is that after he was born, the traumatic labour, but then I'm starting to realise who doesn't really have a traumatic labour in some respect or pregnancy or birth story. I was hit with a debilitating mental illness known as postpartum psychosis that came for me completely out of the blue. I'd had no history of severe mental illness. There was no reason why I should have this experience, but then also no reason why I should not. It landed me separated from Jet when he was just 3 weeks old in a psychiatric ward for 2 weeks, and completely blew my life apart, exploded everything that I knew my 31 years on the planet to be into a horror show, really. And then spent the kind of year after that grappling back what little life I had, rebirthing myself. But, you know, there was this kind of, you know, now I see it, Jet and I were sort of growing in tandem. You know, he was learning to eat and I was learning to feed myself again, or he was learning to walk and I was learning to be in the world again, sort of side by side. So I wrote my memoir, What Have I Done, in that year, and on my phone. And writing that book absolutely saved my life, you know, just setting that story free and building a community and language around it, learning about mental health, understanding it, and conversation just thinking that, you know, knowing that I wasn't all by myself, that other people go through hard stuff and they make it through the other side, saved my life. Really, it did.
It's one of those things that I feel like it's not really talked about that much, or it hasn't been. I mean, I've been a mum now for 13 years, and in that time, there's been so much more conversation around, you know, perinatal mental health and about postnatal depression. But I feel like this is an area that isn't talked about quite as much. And, you know, what are the main differences between postnatal depression and postpartum psychosis? It sounds like it must be quite a different experience.
Yeah. My mum suffered with postnatal depression, and we thought that's what I was going through at first, but this illness is completely different to postnatal depression. It is considered, postpartum psychosis is considered a medical emergency. You know, if you're experiencing the symptoms, which can come on really fast, even before labour, during labour, it's emergency, it's A&E. And how I look at it is it's a heart attack to the brain. You know, symptoms you can look out for are delusions, paranoia, conspiracy theories, euphoria, none in my case, but some people do get support euphoria, lucky ones, hysteria, mania, all the heavy stuff basically. But there's an amazing organization called Action on Postpartum Psychosis that I'm now an ambassador for. It's not really that hard to be an ambassador for Action on Postpartum Psychosis. But I am a proud ambassador, which means, you know, that I spread the word. That's part of my job now. I feel like I'm an enrolled postpartum police officer. The thing about so tricksy about this illness is, well, similar to depression and anxiety in that way, is of course shame unfortunately comes alongside it. You've got the baby that needs caring for whilst you're also desperately needing caring for. So everything's kind of amplified in that notch, in the sense that it's really hard to just roll into a blanket and shut away the world. You know, you kind of need to show up and stick around, and then you've got parental guilt and am I failure and all of this stuff, and am I going to impact the baby's life, and that just goes on to that. And then if I say anything, will my kid be taken away from me? So there's silence and shame all surrounding that, which is just another
That's so hard to deal with, because at the end of the day, like, you as a human being are just as important as the baby. And I feel like that's something that, I'm just saying that out loud, makes me feel like people are going to be judging me. But, you know, you are two human beings. Just because he's been alive for 2 weeks and you've been alive for, you know, 30 odd years, it doesn't make you any less valuable and important. But society tells us that your job as a mother now is to put your baby first, and that's really hard, isn't it?
100%. The first title for the memoir was going to be The Broken Oven, because that was how I felt. I felt like everyone was looking through the little square window watching this cake or this loaf of bread rising, and I'd done all the hard work, and then they ran off to like eat the cake, and I was just like trying to cool down on my own. I was like, I think I'm broken. And it's just such a lonely experience, that bit afterwards. I don't even know how to put it into words, because you're so surrounded, I mean, my experience anyway, surrounded by people to the point that my house felt like Glastonbury Festival, you know, morning, noon and night. But I had never felt so lonely, you know, and those two feelings, straddling them both, conflicts at the same time, feeling so silent and yet everything so loud. And anything to do with illness or difficulties around babies anyway, everyone seems to want to tiptoe and shroud in cotton wool. When actually that doesn't help, that just inflames the silence, makes you feel worse. Like, because there were moments when I felt extremely strong and tenacious and Herculean, you know, like I could move mountains, or my confidence was, you know, so low. But people don't want to talk about it. They're like, you just look on the bright side, everything's upbeat, and it's twisted. It doesn't honour quite how scary the illness can truly be.
Yeah, I'll bet. Am I right in thinking that you wrote a blog post about your experiences, or that you turned some of your book that you were writing into a blog post, and then it went viral? I think that I saw it when the singer Adele shared it on her Instagram stories. But what was that like? Because it's a hugely vulnerable thing to be writing about, and suddenly the whole world is talking about it.
Yeah, so that was what happened first. So when Jet was 6 months old, I knew Clemmie Telford anyway, mother of all lists, and our babies were due at similar times, and I just sort of, we were kind of sharing that overdue sort of experience. I think Clemmie was on her third and I was on my first. And then I just went quiet, so she, you know, kept checking in with me. And writing is how I've always dealt. You know, I've written since I was a little girl and could hold my hand around a pen. That is how I have dealt with everything. And I knew I wanted to write about it, but in all honesty, Alison, I just thought, ugh, that part of my mind is gone. You know, when your imagination has always been your best friend and then it turns on you in such a way, I was like, I can't go there anymore. But of course, that was a small price to pay to be well. But then I just found out it was coming out on my phone. Obviously, I had sleep. This is when I was out of the hospital. I had Jet on my chest, you know, feeding and sleeping. So I wrote, and then we put it out there, and then it went viral. And that was just, I was honestly, that's why the book's called What Have I Done in that first instance, because I was like, why did I do this? Because when you have paranoia, shame, I started thinking that my whole area, you know, knew who I was. I was this like bad person, that, you know, that people were gossiping about me, looking at, which is awful, like really set me off. But actually, I was also learning CBT at the time, cognitive behavioural therapy. And the two things really helped, because I was able to realise that, no, what you're feeling here actually ultimately is shame. And I knew that that isn't a real useful emotion. That's a fake, you know, emotion. And I was able to just go, no, what's actually hurting here is my ego. It's ego death. It's pride. It's like, I wouldn't be embarrassed if I'd been hit by a car. You know, I'd be like, that car bloody hit me. I'd be annoyed. You know, I'd be outraged. Yeah. I'd want to talk about it. Why would this, did I feel like, well, this is my fault? And the hospital stay, I was telling myself, oh, it's like I'd been in the Maldives or something for 2 weeks chilling. It's like, no, I was in a psychiatric ward, like getting better. And I always try and hold on to that. It's like, even in my very worst, I was still being better so I could be a better mum, so I could be better for my family, not because I was being selfish, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but then also it's all right to want to get better for yourself. That really isn't selfish, is it?
Of course.
So what was the treatment? Did you use CBT as you were writing? And were there other things that you had to go through in order to recover properly?
Yeah, I mean, everybody's different, of course. But for me, in my case, I needed medication, a lot of medication in the first instance, because I had to take antidepressants, but they take a while to kick in. So I had to take an antipsychotic as well, which luckily I responded to really well to, and sleeping medication, because that was the problem. After my little boy was born, I had to spend almost a week in a maternity ward. I don't know if you've ever hung out in a maternity ward before, but it's like a carousel of hell. It's just like sharing a floor with eight other people, all having their own stories going on. So crying at different times, waking at different, you know, it's you're there. If you're there, it's because something not good has happened. And it's just, I had this like really horrible side effect to the epidural, meaning that I was scratching all over. I was like scratching till I was bleeding. I had an emergency cesarean. I couldn't move. And it was just, and my little boy wasn't feeding, so everything just, and he was born underweight. And so that just really set off the lack of sleep. I couldn't sleep in this environment. So sleeping medication, and then all the kind of basic things, so that they tell you living sensibly is going to help you, actually does surprisingly work. So, you know, speak to a therapist, and, you know, just taking it easy, not leaving my postcode, eating three meals a day, exercise, all that boring stuff, which is also really hard to fit in around a young child. But but the thing that really did help was writing. It really, really did. And I don't mean that in a really like cheesy, like books save my life sort of way, but reading other people's experience, lived unique experience, knowing human testimony that it is possible to go through hard stuff and come out the other side, was such a gift. Off the top of my head, I'm thinking about writer Clover Stroud, Lem Sisse, Catherine Cho, reading people that had gone through and come out. It was incredible.
Now I think it's safe to say that we're definitely in this era of people striving to be the perfect parent, and we see it all the time on social media, don't we? And it can just make us feel so inadequate. I often had to have a word with myself and like tell myself, you're doing a good job, it's okay. Didn't you recently take yourself off Instagram? And is that, was that linked to the whole feeling inadequate side of things, or was it just a time-saving mechanism?
That's why I'm able to sit here in pink today, not caring, Alison. oh my god, I cannot. I mean, I don't want to be preachy about it. I'm also nearly 4 years sober, and I link the things so closely, you know, that I don't want to be that annoying person being like, but I honestly feel like I've added years to my life of my creativity, for my brain space. Yeah, there was definitely, I would say, that kind of competitiveness accidentally happening. I'm not by nature hugely competitive. My parents kind of brought me up to be more punk in my thoughts than that, like okay to being a bit cringe and doing your own thing. I was okay with that. But you know, does it, when you see someone who's got their nice fancy new kitchen done or garden done or winning an award or got a film deal or whatever, you do start going, oh okay, am I doing life okay, more those things. And I knew that wasn't healthy for me to wake up and see that. Also my little boy would be doing screen time and I'd try and be like, should we do other things like crafts or books or cooking or chill with your friends, and then I'd be there on my phone like, and I was like, this is really hypocritical. Yeah. But the one of the main things I noticed was that my dreams had stopped, so I just wasn't able to dream like I used to. And I thought, was that from being ill, or was that COVID, or was it when I was on the medication or whatever? And no, they've just come back like in an abundance. I feel like things are processing properly. And you know, just recently I've lost two grandparents in a really close space of time, and I would feel like I had to kind of do a tribute to them on Instagram, and I hate that. Yeah. I would have thought like that. I would have felt like, this is the time I get a really classic picture of my grandparent and put it up and write this lovely thing about them. And it's like, no, actually, I just need to be with my family.
Yeah. It's like, who is saying that this is now that social media exists and we all have a profile, this is what you have to do in order to process this grief and go through this time? It doesn't really make any sense, does it?
Honestly. And the amount of love that I've received since, you know, quitting, because it's the same when you give up drink, when everyone kind of wants to go, oh come on, but then they go, oh, but how do you do it, you know, how did you get there? It's lies to us that we need it the same way drink does. You need it to have a good time or to socialize or to network or to be confident. This is the same. It makes you think, oh, but what about your book sales? Oh, but what about your career? Actually, it's doing just fine, you know, because I feel like I'm getting more done, and I feel my creativity is sharp again, you know, that muscle is sharp.
I do feel like it's something that's happening more and more now. I mean, you mentioned Clemmy Telford earlier, and she recently came off Instagram, and she was like one of the OG Insta mums.
Totally.
Also, the writer Emma Gannon has come off Instagram, Donald Porter.
I didn't know Emma had. That's good to know, because Dawn did it. Yeah, she helped me jump off, actually. I messaged Dawn. It took me a while, and I messaged, but that's what happened with sobriety. I messaged someone that had already done it, and I was like, how? She was amazing, and she was like, do it, you won't look back. And actually, Clemmy jumped the day before I did, so I messaged her. I was like, oh my goodness, how did, and she and weirdly she was one of the ones that went sober just before me. So there are, yes, these kind of patterns that you see, that sort of girl, cool girl in the year above that takes the plunge, and you're like, yes.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I mean, honestly, you couldn't pay me to go back on there now.
Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I just think it's really good. We need people to take a step back from whatever it is, whether it's alcohol, social media, you know, things that are considered the norm and just part of the fabric of life. And we need people to step back and be like, okay, what are the pros and cons of this? What am I actually getting from it? You know,
yeah.
You know, let's try removing it from our lives and see what happens. It's not forever. You know, you can go back on Instagram if you want to. But yeah. I just think it's like a really, it's just really healthy. Like, you guys are really healthy role models to the rest of us who are still on there, you know, experiencing it in all its glory.
But one of my friends said to me, and maybe, I know I'm trying, anyone that's out there on Instagram that's still finding it really useful and they really take loads of pleasure from it, you know, I used to feel all those things. I think the algorithm has really changed it and sort of made it slimy and goblin-esque, so you haven't got as much. You know, I absolutely love seeing my friends on holiday and all that kind of stuff, and I, most of my best friends, they'll send me like little reels and stuff of what they're doing so I can keep up. But one of my friends said to me, she was like, you did take it a lot more to heart than a lot of us. Like, I would see something on there and see it like a sort of factual newsletter, like this University of TikTok, and be like, that must be the truth. You know, this is happening, this is happening, that's that. And then she'd be like, but have you read the newspaper? Because that isn't what's happening in the newspaper. You know, and I'd be like, oh, and also so much of the time you don't have control over what you're seeing. So it might be 3 days old, or, you know, it's just all these.
Yeah.
I remember someone just doing a Kate Bush cover and me thinking Kate Bush had died. And it's like, I don't want to go through this.
Yeah, yeah, so true. Now, our kids are a similar age. I had twins in 2018.
Oh, well done.
But I feel like I harp on about like the pandemic and lockdown all the time, especially on this podcast.
Well, it's huge.
I'm always mentioning it. And I feel like people are probably like, stop harping on about it. But yeah, I feel like it had such a huge impact. And, you know, our kids were kind of getting to that stage where they were becoming toddlers and they were needing to be out and about and being with other kids. And suddenly everything stopped and we had to stay indoors. What kind of effect do you think that had on you and Jet and your mental well-being as a family?
Well, you kind of had a little friend then, didn't you, for your kid, which was nice. That's why you had twins.
Didn't feel that way, I tell you. Having two of them climbing the walls.
Oh, my God. I can't believe you did that. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. My experience of COVID, I think, was pretty good for me because I was at home where I needed to be. I took my last medication was due on the day they announced lockdown. I just rang my doctor up and I was like, I can't do this. Like, I just really panicked. I was like, I need to get back on it. He's like, no, you don't. You're okay. Like, I felt very vulnerable. But actually, I had... for the book launch was coming out in the May, it was locked down within the March, wasn't it? So everything got cancelled. And there was a strange notion to that where I was sort of ready to emotionally walk down the streets naked, as in release this book about the severe mental illness. And we had a launch lined up at the Palladium. And I was really gutted when it all got cancelled. But then I was like, no, this is actually where I need to be when this book comes out. Just don't make the same mistake as last time. Be with my little boy, watch cartoons, and just, you're lucky that you can just eat and be at home and just do that. And not having to put on a show, not having to pretend to be well, you know, look to the world that, oh, I'm okay, I'm doing stuff for Instagram or whatever it was.
Because people seem much happier talking about mental health and hearing about it when there's been a happy ending.
So,
you know,
true.
Like, if you're able to say, I went through all of this, but it's okay, I'm okay now, people are much more comfortable hearing your experience, aren't they?
That's so true. And also, nobody was okay. You know, we were all talking about how fucked up we felt. You know, everyone was just discussing, like, how, you know, thinking back that you did that with two small, tiny children, like, and you said the 30 years, so you've been a parent before that, so you must have had an older child as well. It's like, props to you, like, how on earth you were doing that. When you look back, it's hysterical. So nobody was feeling okay. So it was actually quite a safe time to put your hand up and say, ah, not well. So, for me, it was, I'm actually grateful for COVID. It was probably not the COVID as an illness, but the time at home was what I needed.
Yeah. And you grew up in the 80s, 90s. What was the conversation around mental health like when you were growing up? I'm guessing it was fairly minimal.
No, nobody, you know, probably grew up with loads of amazing, wonderful, intelligent and hilarious adults that were all winging it and definitely self-medicating with alcohol. And I just was thinking, yow, this will be my path. You know, my parents are absolutely amazing and were completely top, you know, let me do whatever I wanted in terms of imagine big and dream big. Even though we didn't have much to start with, I felt like there was nothing that I couldn't try and go for, and they encouraged that. And but we didn't talk about mental health. I was of the ignorant, naive belief that you either were one of those people that suffered with mental illness or not. I want to talk about that because I just couldn't believe how naive that was. When I sat there in that psychiatric ward with group therapy we had to go to, so it wasn't a mother and baby unit. I was with, in general, psych, so people living with, unfortunately, alcoholism or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. I was just there like, whatever made me think I shouldn't have been in a place like this? You know, everybody should spend some time in a psychiatric ward. It's enormously humbling, and it's nothing like bloody One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or these films that sensationalise this illness. Actually, it's just people that are ill trying to get better. And when I hear this thing that mental illness is scary, there is nobody more scared than the person that is going through that in the time. You know, you might have a narrative in your mind that is absolutely petrifying. We have this kind of, in our society, where we push people away that are going through mental illness, when actually we should be doing the opposite and bringing people in, making ourselves, you know, the shame needs to come down. So that's why I wanted to write Grey. So with Lauren Child, who is, honestly, this is just another silver lining to the illness. There has been so many, you know, I'm so grateful to get ill because it's just taught me so much. But she was honestly one of my biggest superstar, like, icons. You know, one of the reasons why I do make books as a job is because of Lauren Child, and that the fact that this is the thing that I had so much shame talking about, and that she's like, yeah, I'm going to illustrate this one. It's just like another thing that makes me feel proud. But I just wanted to, my mum was adopted at birth, and I said, did you always know you were adopted? She said, yeah, there was never a time where I remember sitting at the kitchen table and my adopted parents saying, you've been adopted. It just was a fact, you know, that was just part of life. And she said, never make the illness this shock moment that you bring across to your little boy. You know, make sure he always knows it's in the fabric of his being. So I've just always, you know, brushing his teeth, being like, you know, mum's amazing, don't you? You know, what we've done, what we've been through is amazing. And I just knew that I wanted mental health to never be a taboo subject for him. And the fact that I can speak about, you know, obviously I find it hard, I'm still a human, but that I can speak about things like suicide and have an open conversation about that, I'm enormously proud of that. And it shouldn't be this silence and stigma around it. So the picture book is not a deep dive into that, but it's just an open of conversation, and it's not in a frightening way. It's meant to be a book of comfort that just means at bedtime those conversations can take place. I believe that knowledge is power. So that's all.
Yeah, I mean, that's what really struck me as I was looking through the book and reading it. And actually, it made me feel really emotional. And I think it's just because, you know, looking through the book, I thought, we didn't have this when we were growing up, you know. I very much grew up in that sort of time when it was like, you know, stop crying, you're not allowed to really show your feelings. Like there was nobody holding space for our emotions. And it's kind of just wonderful that, you know, we have a book like this that allows us to open up those conversations with our children.
That's so kind. Thank you. I think that don't cry thing you just said has really hit home. And I think it's that unconditional love, isn't it? Like, I remember once Jet saying to me, he was crying, and we'd had, like, you know, sometimes you're just so exhausted at the end, and I was just like, oh God, the crying. And he went, do you still love me? And I was just like, how could you ever think that? Like, sometimes you just have to have that chat with yourself, don't that you, in parenthood, and you're thinking in your mind, like, how could you, like, I have just listened to you for 4 hours and you've bent over backwards on me, like, thrown things or whatever, and you're like spent, and you're like, what more do I need to show you that I love you? Then they can ask a question like that and you just obliterate. It's like, and that was the main thing I wanted to come across in the book, was unconditional love. Depression has this horrible way of making you feel like you've used all your chips up, you know, your tokens, and you're in debt to your family. Like, I know I've just not been feeling good, and guess what, now I'm not feeling good again. Like, I'm so sorry to say this. And everyone's like, you feel like everyone's eyeball rolling or sick of you. It's like, I want the reader to, and the parent to be like, no, I will never be sick, like, of hearing you talk to me, like, this is not going to get boring. Yeah. And that's that kind of real push on love. And using colour, because I did not have a wardrobe for depression, Alison. I had to dig deep. So I think writing about colour, I think people have this idea as well of, like, what a children's author is, you know, as well, that we're meant to sort of be, like, always brightly coloured, and it's always meant to be happy, positive, happy endings. And that's actually quite toxic, you know, to prescribe that kind of emotion on our young people. It kind of doesn't give them, as you say, any wiggle room for those days when you're not feeling quite so bouncy. And it's like, as a kid, to be like, cheer up, put a smile on. It's like too much. Sometimes we don't feel like that. You know, we've got stuff going on too.
It seems like you guys have got, like, a really strong family unit. And didn't you and your partner, Hugh, weren't your childhood friends before you later got together as a couple?
Yeah.
Do you think that makes your relationship a lot stronger than many others?
Oh, Alison, like 100%. The illness, I mean, if you anyone's had that, this illness, or even, you know, mental illness in any sort of shade, it just takes on such a nasty sort of mask where it makes you feel like you're being somebody else, or you're maybe following a narrative. Like, I, for example, was extremely suspicious of Hugo for a lot of my illness and thought he was trying to take Jet, and would say some, or just awful things, you know, and to his family as well, or thinking them in my head. And the trust, you know, you spoke earlier about what may be better, and, you know, they spoke of the meds and CBT and therapy and all that stuff, but the main thing really was this one conversation we had in the ward, where I'd had all these plans in my narratives in my mind of what he was doing, thinking that I was in, like, a lawsuit trying to fight back Jet or whatever, custody battle. It was just really deeply, I was just deeply unwell. And Hugo just turned to me and he just, like, cut through all the psychosis. It was just incredible. And he just said, you know, you thinking that you're to blame for this would be the same as somebody blaming my mum for dying of MS. Like, this was not your fault. Like, you, how could you blame this and on yourself? And that was just really the medicine that fixed me at that point. I'll never forget that. You know, I could burst into tears about it now. I just thought, you have to hold on. You have to hold on here, because someone really does love you. And we had met when we were 13. We'd been to his funeral, mum's funeral, side by side, you know, my mum's remarriage side by side. And everything else along that. We fought so hard as well to make it work as adults, and we couldn't let a mental illness, like, get in the way of that. And now we have these conversations. And we were just saying on the way to school, we both took Jet to school today, which we don't always get to do. And I just said to him, it's like he sees us as, like, a mum and a dad as one. He doesn't go, you're the mum and you're the dad. He sees us as one unit, and it goes to us both for the exact same things. There's no stereotype or tradition in our house, apart from the fact that I am a better cook. That's the only tradition. No, not really. It's just everything is just equal. And I think, do you know what, that's another great thing to have come from this, that we've broken the tradition of stereotype there, that our little boy just sees us as people that love him.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Looking back, what do you think you've learned about yourself since becoming a mum? I mean, there must be so much, right?
Yeah, there's so much. There really is. You know, I always, when I was younger, I always thought, like, being a mum, do you remember when Mel B was pregnant and she had her, Scary Spice was pregnant, she had her belly out and the pictures, the pierced belly button and the tattoos, and I was just like, that's what I'm going to be like as a pregnant person. So cool, so iconic and unapologetic and carefree and all those things. And I really thought, because of the girl power craze, I was very brought up on, you know, that was my breakfast, lunch and dinner was girl power. But then deep down inside, you know, anxious, wait, you know, counting the toilet flushes, trying to get to the bottom of the stairs or stepping on three drains and all those superstitions. I really thought that that was what it meant to be like a strong woman and a strong mum. And I thought about that a lot when I was recovering, like what it meant to be strong. I had to be strong. And actually, I found out that all I was doing by asking that of myself was just setting off all the alarm systems in my body of resilience. Mm. That word is like just so toxic to me now. It's like putting up this shield and this barricade of like, and being hard. And not allowing myself that kind of juicy comfort and space to teach myself self-compassion and hold myself close and be like, no, you know, growing up with parents that also self-employed, that were hustlers, it was like, no, come on, wing it, like, do this. And now I'm just like, put on Schitt's Creek and have a day off, girl. Like, you did not ask for this. Like, chill out. And I try. It's
if you
not
could go back
easy.
And tell yourself something, is that what it would be?
Yeah. It'd be like, stop being so hard on yourself. Like, stop trying to be well and perfect and show the world that you were okay. And in the birth, which is just forever now, stop being such a passenger as well. Like, I just kind of had no autonomy over my labor, which I understand. Like, how was I meant to when it gets to emergency cesarean stations? But I was honestly like to the nurse, I was like to the midwife, have you had a salad? I was like, have you got a boyfriend then? It's like, what the hell? I know, it's like eight different people looking after my body and my child's body. And I just, so yeah, those, but also, yeah, self-compassion is a big lesson to learn. Just being kind to yourself truly, that's been great to learn that.
No. Well, Laura, thank you so much for chatting to me today. Before you go, where can we find you online? Obviously not Instagram.
Well, actually, I've got like a little squad that keep up with things on Instagram. Yeah. So stuff is posted, so you can keep updates on there. It's mostly my sister going, hey, and her or whoever. And they've got a website and all of that. But Instagram really is still the place to be. It's just not me.
It's not you. It's just updates on your work.
Yeah. The nice place to go is a bookshop.
Like it.
Like it. You liked it.
Hence bookshop. Laura, thank you so much. It's been so wonderful.
Thank you,
Alison.
You too as well. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.